Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. Lately, it feels like we just can't get water quite right. Climate change is driving more intense flooding, droughts, and hurricanes, which means we either have too much water or not enough in many places. And the water we do have, well, there are problems with that as well. A family of chemicals known as PFAS that have long been used to make household items from nonstick pans to raincoats and pizza boxes don't break down, and they tend to seep into soil and water. Now, nearly half of the country has PFAS documented in their drinking water. In North Carolina, the Cape Fear River Basin provides drinking water for over 1 million people. It also contains high levels of PFAS. State officials estimate a total of 3.5 million North Carolinians drink tap water with PFAS levels above the EPA's standard. But proposed new state regulations don't go far enough, critics argue, because they don't stop pollution at the source. Meanwhile, on the federal level, an internal memo suggests the EPA may actually weaken hundreds of chemical regulations. And water-guzzling data centers in North Carolina and nationwide could stress both water quality and availability. Today, we're looking at all of that, the state of North Carolina's water systems amidst all these challenges. We're joined by Zachary Turner, WFAE's climate and environment reporter, Brandon Jones, the Catawba Riverkeeper, and Kelly Moser, senior attorney and leader of the water program at the Southern Environmental Law Center. Thank you all for being here.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
So let's start with PFAS. These chemicals are great at repelling grease, oil, water, all kinds of things. They're also linked to cancer, basically never break down, and after decades of lightly regulated use, they're found in much of the water we drink. As I just said, in North Carolina, estimated 3.5 million people drink PFAS contaminated water with levels higher than federally approved standards. Kelly, I understand, however, that the EPA's current administrator has proposed rules or is proposing rules that would actually eliminate the limits on some of these chemicals like Gen X and three other prominent types. What is the latest with this and what is driving this?
Yeah, thank you so much, Eli. It's great to be here. We have been very concerned about the current administration's plans to roll back drinking water standards for Gen X and several other PFAS chemicals. The prior administration adopted long-awaited drinking water standards that were backed by science and protective of human health and communities. And you know, across the country, we were applauding that move. And here in North Carolina, where folks in the southeast of the state have been plagued by PFAS contamination in their drinking water for decades, coming from DuPont and Chemours facility in Fayetteville, that move was welcome. And now, just a few weeks ago, this current administration announced its plans to scrap those drinking water standards. That scrap the standards adopted in 2024 for Gen X and several other PFAS chemicals, and to delay compliance with the drinking water standards for two PFAS, PFOA and PFOS, for utilities that just simply certify themselves that they need more time.
So they basically get to say, we need more time, and they can avoid doing anything right now.
That's right. And it puts the puts communities at risk for many more years because there is no indication that this administration is interested in adopting health protective regulations. This rollback comes at a time when we are seeing overwhelming public support for strong PFAS protections across the political aisle. And these protections we've had advocates across the country from harmed communities advocating for these standards, and those communities are not being listened to.
And I know this problem is particularly acute in the Cape Fear River Basin, where some of those companies like DuPont have operated and polluted for a long time to our east. Brandon, are we in the clear here in the Catawba River Basin? And what do we know about PFAS contamination and, chemicals in our drinking water in the Charlotte region?
Sure. We know a lot more than we did. So there's been tremendous amounts of testing done through our university systems and the PFAS Action Network. And in general, we were looking pretty good in the Catawba. Now, that's not true everywhere, but all of our major drinking water facilities have been testing and are under those recommended guidelines. There are, though, some real hot spots. So we look at like the Charlotte Training Firefighter Academy Center. That area has very high levels. The airport, there's some spills there. Places that you would expect there to be high levels. We're just fortunate in that there's not a lot of exposure. And so we're not seeing that impacting wells because there frankly aren't wells in that area. And so we just happen to be a little bit luckier here in the Catawba than our colleagues out east, particularly in Pittsboro and on the Cape Fear.
And Zach, I know you are, I believe, from Pittsboro. And I know two North Carolina rivers were recently named among the 10 most endangered waterways in the U.S. Not a great list to top. Which rivers were those and why?
Yeah, I will say that it's a little bit less bleak than it sounds. These were rivers that weren't chosen because they were the dirtiest, but because they struck this very particular balance of they are endangered for some very specific reasons, but there's still something that we could do to improve those conditions. Number four on that list was the Lumber or Lumbee River, and this was due to PFAS and agricultural pollution contamination. Namely, industrial waste from the Robeson County landfill was seeping into the river, and this led to fish advisories in South Carolina. There's also a lot of ag waste coming from CAFOs, slaughterhouses, and meatpacking facilities. I believe this is an issue that the SCLC has maybe worked on a little bit on the Lumber River. They were listed in this report as a partner on this project, mm-hmm. So I don't know if Kelly has something to add on the efforts in the Lumber River. But also, the other river that was mentioned in this report was the Dan River. I most recently visited the Dan when I drove to Stokes County to report on data centers. In addition to possible stress from incoming data center development, the Dan is on the in the pathway of the Mountain Valley Pipeline Southgate extension, as well as Transco's Southeast Supply Enhancement Project. The report stated that the permits for these projects have already been awarded, so now it's just in the hands of state regulators to make sure that the Clean Water Act is upheld in the construction of these pipelines, that these developers are held to the highest standards to minimize the contamination, the disruption to these ecosystems and waterways and drinking water sources for that area, folks that depend on the Dan.
So we've talked about federal regulations and the rollbacks that could be coming there. There's also a state plan, and I'm going to describe it as described in a recent story by WUNC. This is, I believe, from the North Carolina Environmental Management Commission. Under the proposal, certain wastewater treatment plants and industrial facilities will monitor their PFAS and 1,4-dioxane discharges for 1 year. Then, based on those results, certain plants and facilities will come up with their own reduction plan. Local and state regulators have to approve the plan, then it's entered into existing permits. Ongoing monitoring is also required. So, Kelly, that's a lot, and we're kind of already wandering into jargon land with the EPA, the North Carolina Environmental Management Commission. There's also the DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality. There's local and state regulators. There's different permits. Kind of break down for us how this state regulation works with both the different state agencies and also federal regulations.
Sure. Thanks, Eli. So North Carolina is unique because we have two state environmental agencies. We have the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, which is our state agency that implements our regulatory programs and enforces the laws to ensure that North Carolinians have access to clean air, clean water, and ensures public safety and health. Then we have an agency called the North Carolina Environmental Management Commission. And that commission is a 15-member body that all members are politically appointed. And the commission oversees the Department of Environmental Quality, sets North Carolina environmental policy, and approves all rules that go into effect here in North Carolina. In the past, the Environmental Management Commission members were appointed largely by the sitting governor. However, that has changed very recently. And in 2023, our Republican-led General Assembly adopted a rule that transferred much of the governor's appointment authority to members of the Republican-led General Assembly and to our agricultural commissioner. And that changed the makeup of our Environmental Management Commission tremendously. Many of the current commissioners have ties to the regulated community. And so we're seeing a real shift from a tradition of adopting rules in North Carolina that are protective of families and communities across the state. And we're seeing this commission instead blocking a lot of the efforts by the North Carolina Environmental Division of Environmental Quality to try to adopt rules to protect families and communities.
So some clashing interests there between the different regulators and also different federal and state standards. It sounds like there are a lot of ways for companies that don't want to stop their discharges or mitigate them because that might cost money to avoid doing so. Is that a fair characterization, you think?
Absolutely, yes. You know, since 2023, the Department of Environmental Quality has been trying to adopt standards based on protecting human health to limit the amount of PFAS and 1,4-dioxane discharges into our waterways and drinking water standards. The Environmental Management Commission has blocked those efforts every step of the way. And now we are seeing the rules that you mentioned at the beginning of this segment called, ironically, the monitoring and minimization rules. These rules lack any mechanism for enforcement. They do not require any specific reductions in discharges of these dangerous chemicals. They do not set any numeric limits on how much of these chemicals can be discharged into our drinking water sources. And they leave communities to pay the price of pollution rather than polluters. And in fact, these rules were actually written by the polluters and regulated community, which is extremely concerning because there is no reason that the regulated community would step up and spend their dollars to protect human health and the environment. And that's what we're seeing here, a rule that just provides that the regulated community can adopt a voluntary measures to try to reduce the levels of these chemicals, and there is just no mechanism for enforcement.
And there's been a big sort of relationship, I guess, between what's happening at the federal level and what's happening at the state level here in North Carolina. I mean, we had Michael Reagan, who worked for NCDEQ. He was, I think, a big part of developing some of these PFAS standards, or was aware of the PFAS situation in North Carolina, brought that awareness and expertise to the federal government while he was EPA administrator. We end up with these federal rules in 2024, which send a clear signal back to the states to promote more PFAS regulation at the state level and local level to hopefully protect these water utilities.
And now we're seeing the opposite. When we return, we will talk more about the state of our water, pollution, and risks to our waterways. That's coming up on Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. Today, we are talking about all things water and water pollution here in North Carolina with WFAE's Zachary Turner, Brandon Jones, Catawba Riverkeeper, and Kelly Moser, Senior Attorney and Leader of the Water Program at the Southern Environmental Law Center. Now, before we dive back into the heavy stuff, I want to clear something up. Is it PFAS or PFOS? Because I've heard both pronunciations here already on this show, and I don't know which one. So who's
Lots
got
to
the
jump in
definitive
there.
answer?
Is it like a
Sure.
data kind of thing, or
It's like data.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
No, PFAS is a class of industrial chemicals that are man-made. There are 1,000 different types of PFAS chemicals. What you've also heard us mention is specific PFAS chemicals called PFOA and PFOS. The latter is pronounced PFOS. So PFOS is just one of the thousands of PFAS chemicals that we are seeing here in North Carolina waterways and that are showing up in our drinking water.
Got it. So it's a kind of a silly question I asked, but I asked it because I think it's germane to the topic of why these are so challenging to regulate. There is a lot of really complicated chemistry, and you've got names like Gen X that sound like, I don't know, maybe a villain in some superhero movie, and 1,4-dioxane, and literally thousands of different chemicals. It seems like we've been pretty successful as a society at eliminating some single chemical pollutants that we can say are bad. Like, we don't put lead in gasoline anymore. We don't use DDT, and we've said, okay, those are bad chemicals. We see they do bad things. They are one and out. Brandon, how much do you think the fact that there are thousands of these different types of chemicals with so many names, with so many differences, how much does that contribute to the challenge of creating a regulatory framework?
Sure, it's a real challenge. We have this expression here in America, innocent until proven guilty, and we apply that to most chemicals. And unfortunately, that makes regulation very difficult. But it doesn't always have to be like that. And we have done this in the past with PCBs. So this is a class of chemicals that are very toxic, they're very persistent. And whenever they started to lead to real challenges, we were able to outlaw those worldwide. Now, you might notice that like PCBs are still there because they're persistent, but at least we're not putting more of them into the environment. And that's one way that we could regulate these PFAS chemicals.
And Kelly.
Yes, there are a lot of these chemicals, and it sounds like it's a highly technical problem, but the solution is not complicated. We know that there are treatment technologies out there today that industrial facilities can use to prevent these chemicals from getting into our waterways in the first place. We saw that happen here in North Carolina, within the Cape Fear River Basin. We discussed this a few moments ago, where Chemours and DuPont before it was sending Gen X and other PFAS chemicals into the Cape Fear River. And SCLC sued the company and, together with Department of Environmental Quality, required the company to install treatment to remove its Gen X and other PFAS chemicals from its air emissions and its water discharges. It is not complicated to require industries to control their own pollution. They have the funds to do it, and they have the technology to do it. That is the only just and cost-effective way of dealing with these contaminants, and it's the only way we're going to get ahead of it, and protect our families and communities.
We've actually seen an example of this right here in our backyard. And so, whenever we started doing PFAS testing, Rock Hill noticed they were discharging around 900, which is a pretty high number. Now, that wasn't impacting the downstream intake, which is 8 miles later, but they were able to go to their significant industrial users, look at their permits, and require pretreatment. And so now they're discharging less than 10. And like they did that on their own with those industries. They didn't require the state to come in. They didn't require anything else. They have the right to require that pretreatment to industries discharging to them.
And that is South Carolina, which is, maybe people might think, boy, I would expect them to be more lax than North Carolina.
I think another point is something that comes up a lot in the PFAS conversation and these stories that we hear about communities that struggle with PFAS in their wells and their drinking water supply is the burden ends up falling for detection and mediation ends up falling on community members. It ends up falling on these water utilities. And that was a frustration that a lot of water utilities had with the EPA ruling is that it is shifting the onus onto water utilities less so than like polluters. But the EPA ruling did send a clear signal to states to maybe start firming up some groundwater limits in order to kind of, again, shift the onus of keeping these waterways clear of PFAS back to the polluters. But then when the EPA, as it's doing now, kind of sends the signal that they're going to roll back these regulations, you have the opposite effect happen at the state level, I would imagine.
And Kelly?
Yeah, it's very interesting with this current administration's latest move to rescind these drinking water standards. One of the reasons they cite is how expensive water treatment is for removing the chemicals. And that's true. However, at the same time, this administration is cutting funding for states and utilities to use to do that very thing, to remove, to install treatment to remove these chemicals. You know, it's been baffling. We hear from this administration that they, you know, they've adopted a deregulatory agenda. We've seen it over and again, and allowing these toxic chemicals in our drinking water and protecting polluters over people is obviously what they mean by adopting a deregulatory agenda.
And I wanted to dive into a little bit more of what Zach was saying about the burden falling on communities and community members. I know you are from out east, the wild lands of eastern North Carolina that seem, you know, very far from Charlotte sometimes, but are really not.
You what describe Pittsburgh as yes. The far east of North Carolina.
I don't go east, man. I live in Charlotte.
Just down there on the Cape Fear River Basin.
What is it like in your community growing up? And, you know, is this something that in the last decade or so, I know you still have family out there that people are talking about more conscious of? And was this something that you worried about or that your family currently worries about?
Yeah, I think that was kind of a big part of my reporting origin story. Getting into environmental reporting was learning more about 1,4-dioxane and learning about PFAS and the Haw River. That is the supply. That's where my parents now, living in Pittsburgh, they're getting their drinking water from, I think Lake Jordan is the reservoir that they're drawing from. But it has had a big impact. My dad, for example, he brews beer, so he needs a lot of water to do that process. And so he's installed a reverse osmosis filter in his home. That was a $700 expense. And he has to, you know, every few months he has to replace the filter for that. So there are solutions that are available to community members if you're in an area where you have PFAS contamination. But again, this falls into that bucket of like community members are one having to find out about this and then, you know, do their own testing. And then they're going and having to buy their own filtration system to combat that PFAS pollution. And they're not receiving any sort of compensation from the polluters who have, you know, put this man-made, non-naturally occurring chemical into the water. It would not be there otherwise. And it's just, yeah, falling under these community members to remove it from their drinking water before they consume it.
Yeah, that's a big burden to put on private community members. Kelly?
Yeah, and in addition to having to incur the costs for treatment in their homes to protect their families from what's coming in through their taps, community members are also paying rates for their drinking water that often they cannot drink. And their, you know, ongoing exposure to these chemicals also requires them to pay in the form of health harms. You know, pregnant women and families have come out in droves at the public hearings that held related to the North Carolina minimization and monitoring rules, and have spoken about how terrifying this is for their families and how this is going to be expensive and how unfair it is to put this burden on people as opposed to the polluters.
And let's step back and just say for a minute why we're talking about this. I mentioned that these chemicals are associated with increased cancer risks of some types of cancer. They're very persistent. But what is the real risk and harm besides that? Let's get a little more specific, if you could.
Sure. Yeah. So PFAS, once they're released, they don't break down in the environment or in our bodies. They have been linked to cancers, they have been linked to harm of babies, fetuses, pregnant women, the elderly. They're linked to kidney disease, liver disease, and the fact that they're not removed by conventional water treatment means that until there are protections in place, people exposed to these chemicals have to fear these types of dangerous health harms.
It's also a move that seems like it's putting the EPA, when they're announcing their intention to roll back these regulations, it seems like it's putting them seemingly at odds with the MAHA movement, that sort of cohort within the Trump administration, spearheaded by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Although this isn't necessarily without precedent. This is, there have been examples where researchers have heard Kennedy, uplifting their research. I can think of some like microplastics research, for example. At the same time, they're seeing the NIH, which is under Kennedy, cutting funding to that very same research. So having something be a tenet of the MAHA movement doesn't necessarily guarantee that that's going to come with protections. But it is something that has been very animating for that cohort within the Trump sort of support group.
Yeah, and it reminds me of what we've seen with glyphosate, the Roundup chemical, where RFK Jr. kind of made his bones with water quality and fighting Roundup and suing them, and now as part of the administration, he's backing an increase in glyphosate production that the administration says is needed. Yeah, what do you make of that kind of contradiction, where, as Kelly mentioned, there's kind of a bipartisan consensus, maybe more than we've seen on, I don't know, any other recent issues, around a healthy living, getting chemicals out of food and water supply, but the actions just, seem very contradictory.
I mean, no, go
Clean
ahead.
water is not political. It shouldn't be. Like, this is a right. This is very clearly defined in the Clean Water Act. We all have a right to swimmable, fishable, drinkable water. And it's not this way everywhere. I mean, again, we work in North and South Carolina, and in South Carolina, we're not having conversations like this. It is very clear cut that everybody wants clean water. The utilities are working together. It's not perfect by any means, and DHEC, now DES, is certainly understaffed and under-resourced in some areas, and it can be very expensive to pull, especially the legacy pollution out. But it's not as contentious there, and so I think that's the disappointment here, is that everybody wants the same thing. We all want clean water, and for our organization especially, we are looking to push this at the local level. We are not going to be able to do a lot in Washington, and we don't need to. Again, like, local states, municipalities have a right to do this on their own. And that's what we're pushing for.
And Kelly, what do you make of this? I don't know if it is a contradiction or not, but yeah, what do you make of this dynamic?
Yeah, it's interesting that the EPA right now is trying to convince people that they're taking action related to these chemicals, describing these rules as necessary for protecting utilities, and ignoring the fact that they're withdrawing protections for people. One of the most alarming things that we've seen lately is that Administrator Zeldin named two employees or leaders at the Chemours Company to the EPA's Science Advisory Board, the board that oversees and reviews EPA's rulemaking. And it's just nonsensical to place members of the regulated community, the polluters who are most responsible for this widespread contamination, to the oversight agency that informs EPA's rulemaking. It's absurd, and I just don't see how we can expect progress from the EPA when it is being led by members of industry.
And Brandon was saying that, clean water should not be political. It's not a political issue. It's not as politicized in some of the other states that where they work. But it sounds very politicized, very political. What do you think is driving that? Are we seeing, industry and profit driving this, or clashing ideologies about the place of the regulatory state? I mean, when you're talking to people who are really in the weeds with this, what do you see as driving this?
Right. I mean, I don't believe that our federal agencies are listening to the people across the nation. And instead, they are listening to industry, their lobbyists. They're worried about their pockets, and they're not upholding their responsibility as employees of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's highly concerning, and they've just abandoned their responsibilities to the American.
And at the local level, where you're doing more work, Brandon and Zach, where you're covering some of these issues as they play out, you know, in front of city council and local commissions, you know, what are you seeing there in terms of politics and water usage and water cleanliness? I mean, is this issue being politicized at the local level, like we are seeing at the federal level, as Kelly's describing, or not?
I can only speak really for the Catawba River Basin. And so in our watershed, it's certainly less so. It's definitely at public hearings, it's a thing, people come out. But in general, most people are speaking in support of more clean water. You know, we don't see a huge amount of industry coming in and trying to defend, you know, discharging. Again, Rock Hill has already started to remove theirs, you know, voluntarily. City of Charlotte is doing, as best as I can tell, a pretty good job of cleaning up the firefighting academy, you know, and so we're already moving towards that, you know, in our watershed. But I think we're very fortunate. You know, if I look at, you know, what's been going on, you know, at the city of Greensboro, or again, the amount of money that Wilmington has had to spend to upgrade their systems, I mean, it is wild. And so we are very fortunate here. But yeah, that's really just on the PFAS front.
We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll talk more about water pollution, water usage, and data centers. That's coming up next on Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. We are talking about all things water and water quality in North Carolina. We've got WFAE's Zachary Turner, the Catawba Riverkeeper Brandon Jones, and Kelly Moser, senior attorney and leader of the water program at the Southern Environmental Law Center. So, data centers have become a big political hot potato. There's fierce pushback at city council meetings and local planning boards across the U.S. People are concerned about electricity use, utility rates, water usage, noise, air pollution from gas generators, and just the, I don't know, the creepy factor of big tech setting up giant windowless data center complexes where there were none before. Water use is a big point of contention. In Edgecombe County, Energy Storage Solutions has proposed a facility that will use 500,000 gallons of water per day. The county has paused that project for now, just in one recent example. So, what do we know about how much water these facilities actually use? Because my understanding is that's not a simple or one-size-fits-all question, right, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on what cooling system they're going to use. Like, for example, in an evaporative cooling system, which works similar to how the human body cools itself down with sweat, a lot of water ends up being lost to air. We can look at the proposed, now canceled, 300-megawatt data center Apex would have hosted, and that would have used 1 million gallons of treated wastewater per day, one-third of which would have evaporated before returning to the Cape Fear River Basin. And I think that's significant. If we're talking about 1 million gallons of water, a significant portion of which is not going to return to the river. If we think about Charlotte during this drought, the Stage 2 drought restrictions, we're looking to bring down water consumption by 16 million gallons per day. And so that represents like a not insignificant fraction of water usage. Meanwhile, some data centers don't use water for their cooling. Some recycle water in a closed loop system, bringing down the overall water consumption by as much as 70%, according to a recent Charlotte City Council meeting briefing. And some even say, like, Microsoft has this pledge to be water positive. This means that they are replenishing more water than they consume, although that does raise some questions about where they are replenishing that water. Is that something that's
local?
Yeah, I was
going to ask that.
They're not bringing water out of the atmosphere and putting it back into the same river they're taking it from, I imagine. There might be a sort of regionality to it. That I don't know. Like with many things with data centers, it just depends on the individual project.
So one issue I see here is that there are so many of these projects being proposed in so many different places. Even if, say, one is 500,000 gallons, one's 200,000 gallons a day, one's a million, can add up to a lot. I mean, it is a lot. Is there any body that keeps track of, monitors, figures out the total usage in, say, a watershed, or are we in a kind of tragedy of the commons situation where, you know, every municipality can approve a user if they think it makes sense, and then everyone ends up using too much? Kelly?
I think you've just used a great term to describe the situation, a tragedy of commons, because we are seeing these pop up across municipalities, and there is not a lot of coordination or understanding of how these compound the issues that, you know, data centers are compounding the issues that we're seeing with drought and water usage. A huge problem in this area is that for advocates and residents near proposed data centers, there is just not a lot of information available about the water consumption. It's a huge transparency issue. And a number of these agreements between data centers and municipalities are taking place behind closed doors. So the information related to water consumption is being withheld by these large companies, either by non-disclosure agreements or broad claims of trade secrets. And that really prevents communities and decision makers from engaging until sometimes these data centers are a done deal.
I think we do have a little bit of information, at least for the Charlotte area. I'm drawing from a memory of a PowerPoint slide from like 3 weeks ago, where Charlotte City Council or Charlotte City staff was briefing the City Council about current data center operations in the area. They were going over like total square foots from tax parcels, and they also went over water usage. I think they were saying of the 16 million gallons a day that they were trying to bring down during these stage two drought restrictions, 0.4% of that quantity was, you know, comes from data centers. That's how much of that pie that they were using.
I would push back a little bit on that number, though, because that's just direct water consumption. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of these facilities, particularly some of the closed loop systems, what really matters is net water consumption. So if you look at the new 400 megawatt one, the Moore Chapel Road, right on the banks of Lake Wylie, for example, even if they don't use any water for cooling, technically, that means that they're all using all the power for cooling. And if they're pulling 400 megawatts from the nearby Catawba Nuclear Station, that's about 5.4 million gallons per day evaporated from Lake Wylie just from power consumption. And so, again, it's transparency. Like, we don't know where they're getting their power from, how much they're using, what are their rates of evaporation for that. And so it becomes very, very difficult to compare and to start to like add up all these numbers together.
And Brandon, what are the impacts look like of these facilities or any big user that takes a lot of water out and maybe puts it back, maybe doesn't? What does it actually look like for the Catawba watershed and our region? Because I think some people picture, you know, a giant straw going into the water and sucking it all out, and then the lake is dry. And obviously that's simplistic and not the way it actually happens, but what does it really look like?
Yeah, and the timing on this is actually quite good because we actually have an answer to that. So for the last 3 or 4 years, the Catawba Water Management Group, which is the group of, you know, Duke and all the intakes, have been pitching in, and they've been developing a model with Research Triangle Institute. And that's exactly the question they're trying to answer, is like, looking into the future, if all these utilities start pulling more water, if we go under different climate scenarios, where will we run out of water first? And what year will that happen? And we see in a high intake year and a high drought year, it's happening now on Lake Wylie for some of those intakes. And so the answer or the what they're trying to figure out now is, okay, what do you do about that? We already have a lot of interconnections, which is helpful for resiliency. You could potentially move some of those intakes or lower them. For the Catawba, we're very lucky in that we have a lot of water here most years. But during a drought, that water is not always in the right place and we can run out. And we have in the past gotten very close to that in the 2006 drought and the 2001 drought. As we move forward with greater populations, greater water usage, we are decreasing that resiliency to handle drought. And if we start permitting a bunch of facilities that can't ration back, then that's going to make our resiliency even lower.
Yeah, it seems like I'm just kind of trying to picture, 10 years into the future. If you're running low on water, you can't switch off the data centers if they're as essential as everyone says they're going to be. People aren't going to accept that. People aren't going to accept turning off power plants. People won't accept taps running dry. I don't know where it is. It sounds like researchers much smarter than me are investing a lot trying to figure that out. But at some point, there is a breaking point, especially in a severe drought year, and climate change makes it more likely that that will happen at some point in the not too distant future.
I think this has definitely fed frustration about data centers, and I think we see this during the drought. We've also seen this in like recent news stories that I've heard parroted during public hearings. So like people are looking at examples like Fayetteville, Georgia, where there's this data center that used 30 million more gallons than it purchased. This wasn't in a single day. This was just like over time, and nobody knew about it until residents started experiencing low water pressure. And I think this resonated with folks like throughout Georgia and in North Carolina, especially during a drought where they're being asked to conserve water. They're seeing these like very visible cues from their local government, from folks that manage water in the area, that residents need to be conserving water, but they're not seeing that transparent side of like what are large industrial users like data centers, what are they doing to curb their water use when it's on a completely different scale.
Yeah, it's a little tough to swallow hearing the take shorter showers message when you've got, a user using millions of gallons being permitted. And one counter argument I've heard, or one pushback, is that data centers are being unfairly singled out in the water usage discussion, and people don't have the same reaction to like a golf course or in California out west, like the almond industry uses an incredible amount of water. Do you think that's just because this is a newer industry and we're kind of used to the concept of golf courses and almond farms, or what do you think is driving the focus on this right now?
I mean, I think there's definitely an argument to be made about golf courses maybe not being super compatible with a climate conscious vision for the future, at least maybe not as they exist now. They're a bit of a biodiversity nightmare, a large monoculture of grass, and on top of that, using pretty, in some cases, comparable amounts of water per day, depending on where this golf course is and et cetera. But that aside, there's a kind of timeliness of it. The utility of data centers is a little bit more abstract, I think, to communities since you don't have like the same kind of job creation as other industrial, like manufacturers.
You also don't get almonds to eat.
You don't get almonds to eat. You can't go play golf at the data center. And they're potentially perceived as more of a nuisance. Maybe people like the aesthetic of a golf course or an almond farm. People certainly don't seem to like the aesthetic of a data center popping up in their neighborhood. We saw this in Western North Carolina. It kind of changes this pastoral image that folks have of their community when you have this kind of industrial box pop up. And yeah, I think it's just location dependent and sort of depends on sort of people's perception of these projects.
So, I wanted to zoom out a bit and talk about the drought and water quality more broadly because, Brandon, I understand that despite all of the focus that we've had on chemicals with exotic sounding names, the biggest pollutant that we're worried about in the Catawba River Basin is plain old dirt or sediment. So what are we seeing right now overall, just kind of with the health of our watershed, and especially in light of the drought and the recovery still ongoing from the damage that Hurricane Helene did? How is the Catawba watershed doing?
Yeah, it's a massive watershed, so it's a bit of a mixed bag. You know, we cover 26 counties, two states, from the Blue Ridge Parkway all the way down to Congaree National Park. And so the impacts are different in different areas. You know, Hurricane Helene really decimated, impacted, you know, basically from the mountains all the way into Mecklenburg County and even below the Wiley Dam. And we saw damages all the way down to the Great Falls. But, you know, Congaree National Park didn't really see as much down there. And those systems are more resilient to flooding. In the same way that the drought has really impacted, you know, portions of Lake Norman, Lake Wiley, and not so much, you know, in other areas that, you know, have more water, have more base flow, or less impacted by that. So, yeah, as you mentioned, our biggest concern in the Catawba most years, most of the time, is stormwater runoff. And so the kind of silver lining of the drought is like our water quality in most places is actually better, because we don't have pollutants being rushed in. You know, we have about 350 or so permitted pollution discharge pipes that, you know, pump in treated effluent to the river every day. But the vast majority of those are meeting their permits and doing a pretty good job. Not all of them. There's a few that we're concerned about. But overall, in the drought, we have excellent water quality in the Catawba. It's when we have these pop-up heavy rainstorms that tons of pollutants get washed in, and we do see elevated levels of fecal bacteria, nutrients, and then that can lead to algal blooms.
And that seems like a contradiction. What challenges do low water levels and drought pose, maybe not just for water quality, but for wildlife and river users throughout this area as well? What are you seeing this summer as we are still, despite the recent rains, in a pretty deep drought?
Sure. So again, it's kind of a mixed bag on where you are, depending on, you know, those species. So, you know, in our upper headwaters areas, you know, low water and high temperatures, really bad for some of our cold water species like our trout, our mussels, things like that. In the lakes, it's kind of different because these are man-made reservoirs. You know, there's not a native species that we're really trying to protect. But for industry, for fishing, for recreation, you know, those high temperatures also can be a major setback. And so in other areas, we've seen fish kills this year, not yet, which is good. But that's always a concern. I mean, the striped bass in Lake Norman, they had to, you know, change those out for hybrid striped bass about a decade ago at a great expense. So that's something that people always look at. These are man-made reservoirs that we are managing for recreation, for electrical production, for drinking water, et cetera. And anytime we go into a drought, you know, we start to stress that equilibrium.
And Zach, I know you've gone on some cleanup expeditions and pulled all kinds of junk out of the rivers, even, you know, pretty recently, stuff that was washed down from Helene. What are you hearing about the ongoing damage and recovery this going into this summer? I mean, are you still planning to go out and cover any more of these events, or are they winding down?
I mean, they're still going for sure. I mean, Catawba Riverkeepers Greg Nance was kind enough to invite me out for a day of paddling and picking up tires out of the Henry Fork tributary of the Catawba. So we spent a whole day out there, and I think we pulled over 1,000 pounds of tires and debris out of the water.
And that was more than a year after Helene, and a lot of that was still from Helene.
I think there's definitely still Helene debris. We saw stuff that were like large, you know, pieces of vehicles. We also found some older debris, maybe some tricycles and some stuff that had been washed downstream by Helene, but a lot of stuff that was there already. So there's an opportunity for folks like the Catawba Riverkeeper to not only clean up Helene debris, but to restore it to a place that was better than before the storm.
That's Zachary Turner from WFAE. We've also had Kelly Moser of the SELC and Catawba Riverkeeper Brandon Jones. Thank you all for this hour. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. See you tomorrow.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.